As long as the milk, for example, is rendered perfectly sterile and kept that way from dairy to processing plant to supermarket, there is no chance of infection. It is perfectly safe and risk-free. Health through control. The contrasting ecological paradigm would require a much broader conception of health, extending to the cows, the land they graze on, and the integrity of the farmers and processors. Raw milk is actually quite safe, but only if it comes from healthy cows, an impossibility under current industrial dairying practices. Cows can only be healthy if the soil is healthy, if they graze and live out in the open, if they are not subjected to artificial hormones and antibiotics to boost yields, and in the long run, if they are not bred to overproduce milk. Since all these requirements conflict with minimizing cost per hundredweight, they are incompatible with the subjection of milk to the commodity markets. All these aspects of control, from cost control to product sterilization, reinforce each other. As is the case with so many other technological fixes, the result of food sterilization is to make it less healthful, not more. Not only is pasteurized food depleted of enzymes and vitamins, but the living bacteria in raw dairy and unpasteurized sauerkraut actually contribute to the intestinal flora that help nourish the body and ward off illness. Sterile food is a target for opportunistic contamination by harmful Salmonella, E. coli, and other bacteria, which need not compete with the original benign bacteria in unpasteurized milk and other foods. Control, once initiated, must be continually maintained. Traditional culinary cultures took the opposite approach by making wide use of fermentation, and not the controlled type, where a single microorganism is used to inoculate a sterilized medium. Traditional fermentation literally invited the world in, relying on ambient microorganisms as well as complex cultures of hundreds of species of yeasts and bacteria that were symbiotic not only with each other but with the human beings they co-evolved with over generations. The results were somewhat unpredictable. Each batch of cave-ripened cheese or naturally fermented wine was unique. Natural fermentation is therefore incompatible with the demands of industrial production and mass marketing, which requires product uniformity and long shelf life. The latest method of sterilization is irradiation, used extensively on spices, meat, and other foods. Basically, the food is exposed to radioactive nuclear waste at a sufficient level to kill anything alive in it. Amazingly, the food remains relatively impervious to new contamination after the radiation has been administered. How could we think that it can nourish human life if it cannot nourish bacterial life? Only from the mindset of separation. The current obsession over food hygiene and the whole campaign of extermination against bacteria starts to look ridiculous when you realize that the human digestive system is not really so different from that of a dog or a pig. The more control we exercise over the world, the more sensitive to the world we become. Despite the fact that they regularly eat off the floor and drink out of toilet bowls, dogs don't seem to get sick any oftener than we do, nor have I noticed any appreciable improvement in health since food service workers started wearing gloves. On the contrary, a lack of regular challenges to the immune system on the one hand primes it to become more sensitive. Maybe I'm missing something, it thinks. While on the other hand, depriving it of the exercise it may need to take on a real crisis. The immune system becomes at once more sensitive, but less able to deal with real challenges. The parallel with the coddled, overprotected modern human is obvious. And I'm reading from The Ascent of Humanity by Charles Eisenstein. I'd like to make a comment here about that last paragraph. It's not accurate to compare the digestive systems of dogs to humans, and I don't know about pigs, who I suspect are more like humans. Dogs have a highly acidic digestive tract, which is why they can eat roadkill. Their stomach has a pH of 1. It is pure acid. So if you're a human being, please don't try to eat like a dog. I suppose it's fine if you eat like a pig. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. The War on Suffering. The war on germs is just one expression of a medical system based on control. Control, in turn, arises from our sense of self, that we are separate beings in an alien and indifferent universe. Not being part of any purpose beyond ourselves, naturally we seek to maximize the security, comfort, pleasure, and other interests of those selves. Technology is one form that ambition takes. If pain, like the rest of life's events, has no larger purpose or meaning, then why not avoid it? The logic parallels that regarding colds and flus. If we are discrete and separate beings in a fundamentally competitive world, then any confluence of interests must be accidental. Any larger purpose must be our own projection. And our well-being must come from gaining as much control as possible over the, at best, indifferent but often hostile universe. Remember the logical conclusion of the technological program, the elimination of all suffering. That this is a feasible goal is fundamental to the assumption that the world is in essence controllable, and medicine is a key technology in implementing that control. Despite its colossal disappointments, the myth of the imminent perfection of modern medicine holds that its technological marvels are on the verge of dramatic new improvements in the human body. Gene therapy to reverse aging, nanotechnology to cure cancer. In such a society, wrote Ivan Illich, people come to believe that in healthcare, as in all other fields of endeavor, technology can be used to change the human condition according to almost any design, close quote. The can-do attitude of the engineer improving on nature motivates such medical fads as the indiscriminate tonsillectomies of the 1930s and 1940s, the routine removal of wisdom teeth in the last two decades, the technological hijacking of the birth process, and at this writing, pronouncements by certain authorities that at least half the population would benefit from cholesterol-reducing drugs. Just as technology in general says nature could use some improvement, medical technology assumes the same of the human body. Hence, we remove the organs that we think are unnecessary, most notably the uteruses of postmenopausal women, and alter body chemistry for the better with hormone replacement therapy. And we think that yet better health will come from the refinement of control to the cellular and molecular level with nanotechnology and genetic engineering. The dogma of control blinds us to the fact of sustained generalized decline in health despite or perhaps because of these interventions. Few doctors realize that the rate of serious birth complications is far lower in Holland, where home births predominate, than in America's high-tech obstetrical wards. They similarly cannot see the horrendous side effects and marginal benefit of cholesterol-lowering statins. The trend of routine medicalization continues headlong. Who knows what medicines they'll be adding to the public water supply, in addition to those already there, such as fluoride. We can already see the final destination of this trend, the medicalization of all life, the conversion of all people into patients. Writing almost 30 years ago, Illich observed that, quote, "In some industrial societies, social labeling has been medicalized to the point where all deviance has to have a medical label," close quote. As children, we were horrified at the Soviet practice of locking up dissidents in mental hospitals under the assumption that anyone who could object to the socialist utopia must be crazy. Today, we are witnessing an analogous phenomenon on a vastly wider scale. Tens of millions of people who find themselves unhappy in our modern technological paradise, this world under control, are diagnosed with some psychiatric disorder and medicated with mind-altering drugs. The same thing happens to children who resist the breaking of their spirits. They are diagnosed with oppositional defiant disorder or attention deficit disorder. I look upon these disorders as signs of health, not illness. A sane, strong-willed child will resist the mindless routines, the busy work, and the hours cooped up inside a classroom. She will steal moments of play at any opportunity. I also think adult depression can be a sign of health. When we have been frightened away from our creative purpose into a life not really worth living, the soul rebels by withdrawing from that life. This is the paralysis of depression. "I would rather not participate in life at all," says the soul, reinforcing its resolve by shutting down the mind, body, and spirit. We no longer feel motivated to live. For a while, sheer willpower and the habit of routine keeps us going, but eventually the soul's call to withdraw becomes undeniable, and we sink into the throes of clinical depression, chronic fatigue syndrome, and the like. Another pathological symptom of health is anxiety, the feeling that something isn't right around here and it needs urgent attention. What is that something? Again, afraid to look into the shadows for the key, we direct it onto trivial fears. However, the underlying emotion is a valid response to the facts of the world. Something indeed is terribly wrong around here, and it does need urgent attention. On the physical side, anxiety has a counterpart in newly emergent diseases such as multiple chemical sensitivity and fibromyalgia. A physical counterpart of ADD is vision problems or dyslexia. You can make me sit at a desk, but you can't make me see straight. The medicalization of these psychiatric conditions is predicated on the assumption that life and the world as we know it is just fine. Like the dissidents in socialist utopia, if living this good life renders you depressed, anxious, or unable to concentrate, well, then you've got an illness, my friend. The problem isn't the world, and it isn't the life you've chosen. It's the chemistry of your brain, and that can be adjusted. One consequence of the killing of pain, whether physical or psychological, is that it makes a painful world more tolerable. Any society in which the intensity of discomforts and pains inflicted renders them culturally insufferable could not but come to an end. If it were not for these pharmaceutical methods of controlling the psychological pain of living the modern life, society as we know it would quickly crumble. The same holds on the individual level. just as the medication of society allows it to exist at a much higher level of pain than it otherwise could, so does a suppression of symptoms in the individual allow life to go on as normal. People on SSRIs such as Prozac have told me that the medicine enables them to cope with life. And it does. It allows life as usual to proceed. The reason that conventional psychiatry, whether pharmaceutical or psychoanalytic, is powerless to substantially help the vast majority of patients is that it does not and cannot recognize the wrongness of the world we live in. The psychiatrists have bought in along with the rest of us. Psychiatry operates on the assumption that we should be happy with it. The same assumption of the rightness, or at least the unalterability of the world given to us, underlies the quest to cope with stress. That life is inherently stressful is not questioned. Psychiatric treatment is infamously impotent to address serious mental conditions because the psychiatrists, as fully enculturated elite members of society, are constitutionally unable to call into question the cultural assumptions in which they are so deeply invested. Their investment blinds them to the underlying rightness and fundamental sanity of a patient's reaction to a world gone wrong. Conventional treatment, particularly pharmaceutical treatment, actually exacerbates the illness by affirming, "Yes, the life society proffers is fine. The problem is with you." I have witnessed dramatic healing simply by affirming to someone, "You are right. This isn't how life is supposed to be." A realization that empowers change. Not that psychiatry ignores the need for change altogether. It's just usually unable to carry the change deeply enough. In essence, it tells us that we need to adjust to the world and seeks to make us normal again, functioning members of society. No, we are meant for more. Everyone can sense the emptiness, the void underneath the forms and structures of modern society. Any psychiatry that seeks to adjust us to such a society is in itself insane. You would be crazy to busily polish the silverware as your house burned down. Similarly, it is insane to live a normal life in today's world. Maybe if millions of children were not malnourished, maybe if torture were not commonplace around the globe, maybe if species and entire ecosystems were not dying, maybe if genocide were gone forever, maybe if all the injustices I've chronicled in these pages did not exist, maybe then the normal life presented to us would be sane. Maybe then it would make sense to absorb ourselves in professional sports, soap operas, the stock market, material acquisition, and the lives of celebrities. Given the reality of the world today, though, the only life that makes sense is to live an extraordinary life. The teenagers, in their idealism and their defiance, the depressed, in their rejection of the lives offered them, the anxiety-ridden, in their sense that something is not right, are all quite sane. Any psychiatry that doesn't recognize this is doomed from the start. It tells us the problem is not the world, it is ourselves. It merely adds to the chorus of voices telling us, all is well, all is normal. Who are you to think any differently? That's the same message we get from the media that immerse us, suggesting with their subject matter that we can afford to care about the trivial and the superficial, the sports, celebrities, and so forth. As well, the whole mania for entertainment suggests that our world is sound enough that we can afford constant distraction from it. Things will be fine. Don't worry. I imagine myself on board the Titanic. Hey, guys, we're pretty far north. Don't you think we should slow down? Hey, guys, isn't that an iceberg up ahead? Charles, relax. Have a drink. Come listen to the band. Everything is fine. See? No one else is worried. Not only do we live today in a fraudulent, life-denying society into which nobody fits, but the incompatibility of that society with human fulfillment only grows with each passing year. Along with it grows the need for medicating expanding swaths of the population. We see this happening with the increasing ubiquity of SSRIs and similar drugs across every age group. The world grows more painful physically as an increasingly toxic environment gives rise to new diseases, as commerce and industry corrupt the food supply, and as the tempo and pressure of life as usual quickens. All of these factors accelerate the conversion of citizens into patients. The medicalization of society contributes to life under control in another way by the authority it invests in doctors. A schoolteacher friend of mine told me that school policy only allows his third graders to visit the bathroom 3 times a day, the only exception being, you guessed it, children with a note from their doctor. When we give authority to judge the health and illness to a doctor, someone external to the person suffering or not suffering, we are attempting to objectify pain, the primary indicator of health. While explicit attempts to quantify pain have failed, the ostensible objectivity of the doctor's note and its current incarnation in the reams of paperwork that our medical system generates allows human health to be incorporated into the framework of technological society, which must treat it, like anything else, according to the standardized, anonymous, objective methods of industry. That is, it becomes the province of certified specialists. Unfortunately, the objectification of illness and professionalization of medicine have also separated ourselves from our own bodies, rendered us helpless to heal ourselves, and made pain and illness all the more frightening. The killing of pain is oddly reminiscent of the mentality of agriculture. Just as the farmer pulls out the bad plants, the weeds, to maintain a field of only good plants, crops, so do we discriminate between good and bad feelings. Life under control means eliminating anything that might cause a painful sensation or feeling, an objective tantamount, we think, to eliminating the suffering itself. The confusion between pain and suffering is fundamental. Suffering comes not from pain per se, but from resistance to pain, and more generally, from resistance to life. It is no wonder that technological society, predicated on the elimination of pain and the control of nature, has generated suffering unprecedented on planet Earth. Technology, which resists the ordinary processes of nature, is mirrored in our psychology as a resistance to the ordinary processes of life. Our internalized dictator, the voice of culture, judges and filters our every feeling and emotion, clinging to the good and weeding out the bad. Attachment and aversion, precisely what Buddha identified as the origin of suffering. The internalized dictator that seeks to maintain and extend control over our every thought and emotion is nothing less than an Orwellian big brother who is always watching. The thought police are always on patrol in this ultimate tyranny of the finite part of ourselves over the infinite. Illich writes, "Good health means to be able to feel alive in pleasure and in pain. It means to cherish, but also to risk survival. The first step to freedom is simply to allow yourself to fully feel whatever there is to feel. This, and not mind control, is where the true benefit of meditation lies. This is also what is meant by accepting God's gifts. If God is good, then every moment is by definition a gift, and to deny it is to separate oneself from God, the Jewish and Christian mystics' explanation of suffering. The technotopian promise that the pain can be killed has led us to believe that the pain need not be felt, and this belief generates a resistance to pain that exacerbates the suffering all the more. The promise is a lie because pain is unavoidable. To be human is to be born into pain. Loved ones pass away. Good things come to an end. Our bodies get old, sick, and injured, and someday we die. Let us not pretend that technology will someday eliminate such occurrences, nor pretend that such occurrences are not painful. Suffering only comes when we do not allow ourselves to feel the pain, when we resist it. That effort is quite logical when we buy into the big lie of the world under control, that pain need not be felt. When we operate under this delusion, we inevitably become resentful of our pain, and therefore prone to all the abuses of victim mentality and entitlement. Our deluded conflation of pain and suffering means that the medical program to reduce and eventually eliminate suffering is doomed. What's more, because suffering comes from resistance to pain and not from pain itself, the focus of medicine should not be on the elimination of pain. Yet this is what reductionistic, symptom-oriented medicine naturally tends toward. While such painkillers as morphine are valuable and have their place in medicine, the role of a true healer is not to make life more tolerable, which is essentially what the suppression of symptoms does. No, the role of the healer is just as Illich implies, to help the patient feel more alive in pleasure and in pain. We go to the doctor because it hurts, and our explanation is that he will give us something to make it stop hurting. That is an error. Pain is our friend, never to be sought out, of course, but neither to be resisted. Let it hurt. When we feel what there is to feel, we cease maintaining separation between ourselves and our sensations, and therefore come into greater wholeness, greater health. The full experience of pain opens the door to health. Whether we are on the sickbed or facing the psychological pain of life's transitions, or the subdued agony of life in a world gone wrong. When we allow the full experience of pain, the window to health that opens may indeed utilize the skills of a surgeon, homeopath, herbalist, or other healer. I am not enjoining the reader to forego all medical care, please. But bodily recovery is not the only benefit, which is fortunate because the result of healing might not always be what we hope for. There can be healing in death as well as in recovery. Another benefit of non-resistance to pain is that it brings an unexpected miracle. The pain doesn't hurt as much. Even if the pain is still there in all its intensity, we don't suffer as much from it. In this regard, pain is much like any other object of control. Control generates its own necessity, which intensifies over time at ever greater cost. Health means to be alive in pleasure and in pain. I have always thought of this book as a work of healing, and I hope that in reading it you feel more alive. Returning to the depression, anxiety, etc. I discussed above, I cannot and will not ameliorate that suffering by assuring you that it's not so bad, that everything is okay. No, it is every bit as bad as you suspect, and even worse. When we awaken to the enormity of our crisis and the magnitude of our loss, often the first response is a crushing despair. I have been through that. I know what it is like. Yet on the other side of despair is fullness and an urgency to live life beautifully. we can choose a different world, the more beautiful world our hearts tell us is possible, and to which I have dedicated this book. But to choose it, we must be familiar with what we are choosing. We must be fully cognizant of the world we have chosen up until now. Knowing the pain of the world fills me with energy and confirms the rightness of my life's direction. Otherwise, what would stop me from occupying my hours with the trivial and the vain, staying comfortable for as long as possible until I died? We need not avert our gaze from ugliness and pain in order to live a happy life. Ignorance is not bliss, quite the contrary. The more we insulate ourselves, the weaker we become, the less able we are to take on reality. The more we numb and defer the pain, the more afraid of it we are, until we willingly submit to confinement in the temporarily secure, predictable, controlled semblance of life our society offers. And I'm reading from The Ascent of Humanity by Charles Eisenstein.
All you losing factory girls, I want you to understand, I'm gonna leave this factory and return to my native land. Sing dum-dee-wickety-dum-dee-way, I'm gonna go so far away. Dum-dee-wickety-dum-dee-way, I'm gonna leave this town someday. No more will I take my shaker and shawl and hurry to the mill. No more will I work so goddamn hard to earn a dollar bill. Sing dum-dee-wickety-dum-dee-way, I'm gonna go so far away. Dum-dee-wickety-dum-dee-way, I'm gonna leave this town someday. No more will I take my talent soap and go to the sink and wash. No more the overseer will say you're making a terrible splash. Sing dum-dee-wickety-dum-dee-way, I'm gonna go so far away. Dum-dee-wickety-dum-dee-way, I'm gonna leave this town someday. To comb my hair. No more the overseer will say, what are you doing there? Sing dum-dee-wickety-dum-dee-way, I'm gonna go so far away. Dum-dee-wickety-dum-dee-way, I'm gonna leave this town someday. No more will I take my bobbins out, no more will I put them in. No more the overseer will say, you're weaving your cloth too thin. Sing dum-dee-wickety-dum-dee-way, away. Dum-dee-wickety-dum-dee-way, I'm gonna leave this town someday.
Our medical system, with its war on germs, illustrates a general feature of control. Just as the unchallenged immune system fails to develop, yet also becomes oversensitive, and just as pain becomes more frightening in proportion to our efforts to numb and defer it, so also does our insulation from risk, challenge, and discomfort leave us weak and afraid of the world. When we are deprived of the opportunity to explore our limitations, we become more fearful of them, more tightly bound to them, and less able to cope when, despite our strivings for control, reality presents us with a new challenge. This deprivation starts early in childhood with the playpen, the hovering parent, and more generally, the regime of safety first that has infected modern society. Remember the latter part of Illich's definition of good health. It means to cherish, but also to risk survival. Traditional societies allowed children productive, sanctioned ways of exploring their limits. Real limits, not the phony freedom of the playpens, contained safety. Moreover, the consequences of their mistakes were real. The parent might say, "Don't poke that beehive or the bees will sting you," but would not, through physical or verbal coercion, try to prevent the child from doing it anyway. The result was that the parental voice gained an authority far beyond the fear-based coercive power today's parents exercise. At the same time, the child learned that consequences are real. John Taylor Gatto has observed that one of the unspoken lessons of school is that actions have no real consequences. Children are essentially not permitted to fail, not at anything real. Children and parents, too, tend to praise shoddy work in order to boost self-esteem, not understanding that the child herself knows the difference, at least at the beginning. Eventually, though, the child confuses praise from authority with the genuine article of satisfaction in the creative process, preparing for a life of doing it for the grade, for the client, for the paycheck. In this way, we early on become strangers to what we really love. Our passions are lost to us, and so we lose our passion for living. On the flip side of the coin, the absence of real punishments teaches children that socially destructive behavior has no consequences. But even punishment is only a substitute for real consequences. When my son Matthew was 4 or 5, he wanted a pocket knife just like his big brother. I decided to give him one, explaining carefully, "This knife is sharp, Matthew, and if you are not careful, you will cut yourself." What happened? He was not careful, of course, and he cut himself. Not too seriously, but it hurt, and there was blood. What did he learn from this? For one thing, he learned that knives are indeed dangerous, on their own merits, and not because one might get caught using one without permission. The second thing Matthew learned is that Dad is one smart dude. Dad was right about the knife. When Dad says something might happen, it's a good idea to listen. No matter how deeply and thoroughly we frighten children with our power to invoke their survival anxiety, their natural curiosity and compulsion to test limits will eventually provoke them to try it anyway, often in secret. When they find, as is often the case, that the consequences aren't as bad as their parents said they were, then parental authority loses all credibility. They find that no one loses an eye when they throw a paper airplane indoors, that they can smoke marijuana and not wake up in a crack house, that reading Harry Potter does not lead to satanic ritual sacrifice. Now the stage is set for tragedy. On the one hand, they have always been insulated from the real consequences of their actions. On the other hand, the imposed substitute consequences, punishments, are no longer effective because the wily teenager easily evades them by deceiving authority, not by abstaining from the behavior. The result is that the teenager acts as if he were immortal or invulnerable and lies to his parents about everything he does. Because human beings have an inherent need to explore boundaries and challenge limitations, today's obsession with safety forces teenagers into illicit, highly dangerous risk behaviors. A lifetime of pent-up desire to know their limits explodes outward at the first taste of freedom, for instance, when they go away to college. Tragically, these behaviors nonetheless fail to challenge and expand significant boundaries. The inescapable fact is that although the exploration of one's boundaries is inherently unsafe, there is no other way to grow. When my 5-year-old son says, "Daddy, watch how high I can climb the tree," I restrain myself from stopping him. And as a matter of fact, Matthew turns out to be quite prudent. "It is not my authority. You can't go higher than that branch," but rather his own caution that limits his ascent. Imagine the consequences when time and time again, parental authority halts a child's exploration before the limits of caution are reached. He will come to depend on external authority to define safety and danger on his behalf, while his own judgment atrophies. Never having had a chance to develop his own judgment, such a person is wont to take foolish risks. Yet paradoxically, because he is chronically dependent on authority to define danger, such a person is also easy to rule through fear. I leave the political consequences to the imagination of the reader. Not much imagination is required, though. Just read the newspaper. Of course I know that climbing trees is dangerous, and that scotch tape can't hold together wood, and that it's much too hot a day for long sleeves. And scientific experts can tell you the most up-to-date, optimum ways to eat, to exercise, to learn, to stay healthy, to be secure. But it is one thing to state my truth. "Matthew, you are going to be hot in that sweater." And another to presume to force someone to abide by it. As Gatto says, "The plans true believers lay down for our lives may be better than our own when tested against some official standard. But to deny anyone a personal struggle is to strip humanity from their lives. What are we left with after our struggles are taken away? But some unspeakable Chautauqua, a liar's world driven by the dishonest promise that if only all rules are followed, a good life will ensue." Close quote. I would like to add that I don't let my 2-year-old run out into a busy street. I protect children from dangers that are beyond the horizon of their understanding. The regime of safety is a facet of the world under control, directly traceable to underlying assumptions about life, self, world, and purpose. It is an outgrowth of the survival anxiety implicit in our understanding of who we are, discrete subjects, and why we are here, no reason, just the random outgrowth of the struggle to survive and reproduce. All is well known. The safe is very rarely fun. What is safe is almost by definition predictable, free from the random variables that engender risk. By the same token, safety is inimical to creativity, which is about novelty, and therefore inimical to play. Hence, the demise of unstructured, unsupervised play in favor of the contained, the controlled, and the programmed that has infiltrated younger and younger age groups. The regime of safety, like the rest of the world under control, requires constant maintenance in order to quell the inborn human compulsion to transcend old boundaries, that is, to grow. The control starts out external and overtly coercive, then gradually becomes subtler and more deeply internalized. Usually, the last visible hurrah of this drive to transcend is expressed in adolescence, and goes by the name of immaturity, teen rebellion, or youthful idealism. By the early 20s, most of us have learned enough self-control to be trusted outside the confines of overtly coercive institutions, such as schools and prisons. We are then dead in spirit, a condition which goes by the name of maturity. Or if not dead, at least beaten, broken, subdued. Yet the fundamental energy to grow, frustrated though it is still latent, and still a potential threat to society built upon diminishment of human creative energy. Society, therefore, channels this energy into various illicit or out-of-the-way outlets that do not threaten the status quo. This is life in the playpen, a contained environment where we can't make too much of a mess. Three examples are especially illuminating. First is the self-destructive behavior of getting wasted, i.e. the abuse of drugs and alcohol. Along with high-risk activities such as skydiving and speeding, and the imitation of such activities in amusement parks. When all other avenues for the transcending of limitations are denied, whether in fact or in perception, then self-destructive behavior is a logical result. If not any other way, I shall transcend my boundaries by dying. Related in origin to violence against the self is violence toward the world. It is a desire to smash the world that seems to conspire to hold us stagnant. An enormous anger lies latent just underneath the veneer of our civility, an urge to break, to smash, to burn, that manifests at the first sign of breakdown in the controlling authority. Ordinarily, society channels this violence toward victims who are insignificant to the preservation of the status quo, anything, essentially, that falls into the social classification of other, which could be minorities, foreigners, other species, or the land itself. Previously, I defined violence as longing denied. Thinking along the same lines, Joseph Chilton Pierce traces it to frustrated transcendence. Violence is what happens when we can see no possibility of ever realizing that more beautiful world and more beautiful life our hearts tell us is possible. The third example of channeled desire for the expansion of boundaries is identification with sports teams, movie stars, and TV characters, which provide us with a second-hand counterfeit of the experience of striving after great things and pushing our limits. Of course, actual participation in sports and in drama provides genuine opportunities to test the limits of who we are and what we can do, and as such to be part of the unfolding human potential. But most of the time we settle for watching other people do it. Another channel is the ersatz rebelliousness of impudent hairstyles, rebellious clothing, rude music, outrageous sneakers, and other statements of individuality via shopping. While these outlets or diversions might pacify us temporarily, the human spirit eventually recognizes the fraud and begins to seek the authentic article of transcendence. The untapped rage that results from the frustration of the natural desire to explore our limits and grow can only be contained by elaborate systems of control, both external and internal. Of course, the control only worsens the frustration, which aggravates the rage, which necessitates the intensification of the control in a never-ending vicious circle. As I have described, in childhood, the control is established by the threat to survival implicit in parental rejection. Internalized early on, it requires constant reinforcement, for the human spirit is strong. Because we cannot discern the object of the rage, because it immerses us, we channel it toward sanctioned targets and through sanctioned means. When we do by chance hit upon the real target and threaten the status quo, the punishment is swift and sure. The lesson we learn when we lash out against the forms, institutions, and functionaries of authority is that resistance is futile, as when the high school student sets off a smoke bomb in the bathroom. Any challenge to their authority sends school administrations into paroxysms of panic. An independent student newspaper, a senior prank, a spontaneous symbolic rebellion where every student wears black one day. One of my students related a typical image. The principal pacing in front of students waving an underground student newspaper, livid, screaming, "Who is responsible for this? I want names!" And so, exemplifying the vicious circle outlined above, the regime of control tightens inexorably in our schools, many of which now have video cameras, police patrols, chain-link fences, random unannounced locker searches, metal detectors, drug-sniffing dogs, networks of informants, undercover police posing as students, and a comprehensive system of passes, so that there is a record of each student's authorized whereabouts at all times. What a perfect preparation for life in a prison or a totalitarian society. The result is much what we should expect from any series of technological fixes. More control has made the situation far more explosive and not any safer, justifying yet more control. It parallels the results of the technological program. Life is not actually any more secure, leisurely, or comfortable, and the entire edifice teeters on the brink of catastrophe. Totalitarianism is the inevitable destination of a society based on the technological program of achieving complete control over reality. As a practical matter, the engineering managerial mindset naturally applies its methods, the methods of the factory, to governance as well as to manufacturing, promoting the complete inventorying, tracking, numbering, and classification of the population. Its technologies as well lend themselves to control. Witness the Orwellian possibilities of biometrics and continuous automated surveillance in the computer age. On a more theoretical level, the falsity of the self-other distinction means that control over the world, the other, will result in the subjugation of ourselves as well. As Martin Prechtel puts it, quote, "When the entire world is fenced and farmed, we will all be in prison," close quote. Or as Derek Jensen says, quote, "When we imprison another, we must also place one of our own in prison as a guard. Likewise, when we imprison a part of ourselves, other parts must move into that same dungeon," close quote. Complete control over the world inevitably leads to complete control over ourselves as well, both on the collective political level and on the personal moral level. With each intensification of control, the individual and collective human spirit seeks new outlets, new doors to freedom, which, when they are slammed shut, intensify the longing even more. The world under control is like a leaky pressure cooker. As each leak is filled, the pressure builds up to cause other previously invisible seams to burst. The program of complete control aspires to seal off all possible leaks once and for all. I leave it to the reader to imagine what happens then. Control of the world inherently involves separation from nature. Just as the very idea of technology requires an objectification of the reality it seeks to manipulate, control implies a circumvention or alteration of what would otherwise naturally happen. Of course, as I observed in Chapter 2, each part of nature exercises purposeful effects on the environment all the time. Control is not the exclusive domain of human beings, so we might consider control and separation to be, in a sense, themselves natural. As many an armchair philosopher has observed, human beings are a part of nature, so everything we do could be considered natural. The damage comes from the mistaken belief that we are separate from nature, and not from actual separateness. It is this misperception of separateness that allows us to suppose that we might be exempt from nature's laws. The very word nature, as ordinarily used, is a symptom of the problem, as if there were some other realm, non-natural, that were exempt. So when I speak of our separation from nature, what I really mean is a forgetting, a detachment, a delusion. It is everything that makes us think that nature's laws and processes do not apply to us. To say that all organisms exercise control over their environment smuggles insidious biases about the nature of self and world. Control implies a reduction of uncertainty, a reduction of deleterious possibilities in favor of beneficial ones. It implies as well an imposition of power over the environment. But when self and environment are not so rigidly demarcated, when an organism is not seen just as a discrete unit competing for resources, but also as an integral organ in the functioning of the whole, then the whole concept of control loses its coherency. We could equally view the environment as inviting the effects that particular organism has by offering a corresponding niche. The behaviors of all living creatures make a contribution to the functioning of the planetary ecosystem. There is no waste in nature. Nothing except thermal radiation is ever thrown away. There is no away. The error of separation is that we have convinced ourselves otherwise, not that we have actually succeeded in separating ourselves from nature. If human behavior and technology were informed by such a non-dualistic view of self and environment, then our goal as conscious, self-aware beings would not be the supersession of nature implicit in the Olympian ideals of technotopia, but the discovery and fulfillment of our proper role. We would seek to conform technology to the rules and patterns that govern the rest of nature. There would be no waste or externalities. In the later chapters of this book, I will advocate going back to nature, not in the sense of abandoning technology, but rather to reconceive all activities of technological society in terms of natural laws and processes. To do anything else is folly. If our dualistic separation of self and environment is indeed a delusion, the next chapter, then, will return to the scientific issues raised in the way of the world to describe the crumbling of the scientific underpinnings of the discrete and separate self in an objective universe. And that was the conclusion of Chapter 5, The World Under Control, from The Ascent of Humanity, The Age of Separation, The Age of Reunion, and The Convergence of the Crises that is Birthing the Transition by Charles Eisenstein, published in 2006. Next week, we'll begin the next chapter. In the meantime, you can read on or read more from Charles Eisenstein on the web at ascentofhumanity.com. And you can download an MP3 of this and all previous readings of the show at unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you very much for listening.